we're going to talk cars. Consumer Guide Automotive is great. It's awesome. You can check it out at consumerguide.com. Tom Appel, follow him on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. car_guy_Tom. Tom Appel, everybody. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good, thanks.
All right. So one more time, very quickly, for those people who might not know, even though you're on monthly with us, tell everybody about Consumer Guide Automotive.
Yeah, we've been around since 1967. We were famous for years for our monthly new car review guides. Now we're entirely online. All our new car stuff is at consumerguide.com. We try to have some fun with the car news and with auto culture at the cgdailydrive.com blog.
Okay. All right. And we always talk about car-related news stories and issues, and we talk about what you guys have been writing about, you in particular, on the CG Daily Drive stories and blog. And
yeah.
We're going to get to all of that. And to answer your questions at 312-981-7200, you can call us in or you can text your questions, any automotive-related question at all, especially if you're looking to buy or you're interested in trading in, all that cool stuff. 312-981-7200. Tom, hang on, okay?
Will do.
Got to take care of a little business here, Tom Appel, and then we'll go right to your questions and talk more car stuff with our buddy Tom Appel from Consumer Guide Automotive. 312-981-7200. Morning, everybody. Yeah. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. Here till 5 o'clock. And we're talking with Tom Appel. Tom Appel is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and he is here to answer any and all of your car and automotive-related questions at 312-981-7200. You can call in and ask a question, or you can text. Let's get Tom on the line. Welcome back, Tom.
Thank you.
Okay, here's an we always talk, one of the things that comes up every single time you're on, Tom, are recall situations.
Yeah.
And we've had many to talk about. And now there's a kind of a disturbing story out there about there's millions of recalled cars that are out on the road as we speak.
Yeah, it's getting to be a big problem because we have the Takata airbag situation that won't go away. It seems like every time manufacturers catch up with the situation, new cars are added to the list. But a recent survey of vehicles that should have been recalled indicates that between 50 and 75% of all recalled vehicles are ever actually corrected. And obviously that's a huge problem because a lot of these issues are safety-related issues, and they need to be fixed. Now, the good news is if you buy a car and you don't know its history, you can go to safercar.gov, plug in your VIN, and find out if there was a recall, and easily find out if your vehicle needs to be taken care of.
That's a good thing to know.
Yeah, you got to do that. You absolutely have to do that when you buy a car.
Safercar.gov.
Yes.
Safercar.gov. Okay, remember to mark that down. That's pretty important. Now, why, when someone is selling a car, they have to be don't they have to be completely 100% honest about it? But how do they police that?
Yeah, there isn't any uniform law, however, requiring people to do or take care of these safety recalls. So a vehicle that's still under warranty, and if it's being sold used through the original brand dealership, that's probably going to be taken care of because it's in their system, they know about it, and they get that fixed for you. But if you buy a car used through a second party, something like that, people don't even know, they didn't pay attention, they got a piece of mail that they didn't, they just ignored or threw out, they thought it was an advertising thing. And just it never got done. And people might recall that it was, I think, a year and a half, 2 years ago, the government came down hard on Chrysler, which is now Fiat Chrysler, or FCA, for having a very low compliance rate having to do with a bunch of safety recalls on Jeep and Dodge vehicles, on Jeep and Dodge trucks. Mm-hmm. And they were accused by the government of having dragged their feet in getting these done. So to a great extent, the government makes it incumbent on manufacturers to get people to come in, and General Motors was put in a position to actually issue gift cards to people to come in for the ignition recalls.
Right.
And you would think that would be scary enough that people would come in voluntarily, but that wasn't the case.
Wow. Now, what are some of the other reasons why there are so many recall cars that are roaming around out there? Are there people who just, if they get a recall notice, just ignore it? Why would they do that?
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on, and I think a lot of people ignore it. They don't realize that the safety risk is actually there. Additionally, there have been so many recalls in the last couple of years. I think that since the Toyota sudden acceleration scare, which turned out not to be a single actual problem, but a series of different things, people sort of started to go numb to safety recalls. And then they confuse them with other things. I think people think that there's already a recall right now in the Volkswagen diesel scandal, which there isn't. There isn't a fix yet. There have been the Takata airbag scandals, the General Motors ignition recall. And every time there's one of those big recalls, other manufacturers sneak in small ones underneath the news so they hope they don't get noticed. And they don't get the publicity that they used to because there's been so darn many of them.
Well, and that's increased in the years, right, Tom, because, you know, the companies want to cover their butts, right? They'll do recalls a lot quicker. They'll make that decision a lot quicker than they used 2 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. They used to drag their feet on that. And now the way that the media responds to recalls and the lack of action on them has made it just much more important for manufacturers to get in front of these things. Manufacturers that look proactive generally don't come off looking too bad in the case of recalls.
Now, what are the most common recalls and of the millions of cars that are out there roaming around, potentially, you know, accidents and risking lives and stuff, what are the most common recalls that are out there right now or that usually are?
If you take out the Takata airbag and the GM ignition switch thing, you run into a lot of little recalls. Little batch recalls for things that could theoretically cause fires. And they tend to be very small numbers of things where something just didn't align right or wasn't delivered correctly or something like that. And they tend to be little underhood things. And the fires never actually happen. Just someone discovers that maybe there was a risk with this batch of parts and they just get that fixed. And they tend to be fairly small recalls, just a few thousand vehicles as opposed to these tens or hundreds of thousands that we've been hearing about.
Mm-hmm. Now, when are these cars discovered that they were recalled cars? Usually after the accident, that's when it's discovered?
Yeah, what happens is that the different organizations start to compile statistics on accidents or under reports of underhood fires or of seatbelts not being latched, things like that. And when there's any sort of statistical anomaly where all of a sudden there's like five of these particular vehicle been involved in this kind of accident, people look more closely at them. And that's how that thing starts. And one of the nice things we have going on in the U.S. is fairly uniform reporting of accidents and investigation of them. So we can compile these statistics and look at these things perhaps in advance of bigger problems.
Is there a step that can be taken to, if a car is discovered as a recall car, that there are a bunch of them out there, how do they track them down? Is it possible for them to be tracked down while they're out there?
Yeah, the auto manufacturers are pretty good at it. They usually know who owns the car. And when a recall takes place, they can go through the state DMVs. And the government usually works very closely with manufacturers when they need to reach the owners of these vehicles. So they can tell who the current owner is by registration.
What's the biggest recall that you can recall? Hey, how about that?
Yeah, this Takata airbag thing.
That's the one, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a series of large recalls, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger. And initially, we thought it was just limited to a number of Japanese makers, but now, like, Ford is involved with the F-150, and it just keeps spreading.
Now, in all the years you've been covering this, Tom, and you've been covering, you know, the consumer beat for cars for many, many, many years, what is the most dangerous recall that you can remember?
I think dangerous in terms of misinformation and confusion was the Toyota sudden acceleration recall, only because it was a series of recalls, but no one was ever able to actually identify a single cause of the problem. You may recall that for a while, Toyota was asking people to take floor mats out of their vehicles, and then they shortened brake pedals. And there was just a bunch of things that happened, and ultimately, the only real fix that took place was reprogramming of how the ignition, the push-button start worked to allow a car to be turned off while it was driving more easily in a more predictable manner. And I think that during that, I think everyone was frustrated, including people in the media, that we couldn't identify or that no one could identify an actual single problem.
Yeah. Now, what about now? You probably weren't covering the beat when the Pinto thing happened.
No.
In the 80s. But that's the one that I remember as being like kind of the granddaddy of all recalls.
Yeah, that was a big recall, too, in that it was very clear that Ford had dragged its feet on the recall, and rather famously, someone at Ford had suggested that it was cheaper to handle the lawsuits than to fix the problem, which was just a tragic situation. It made the auto industry look terrible. Yeah, but that was the Pinto and Bobcat, the Mercury Bobcat.
Oh, the Bobcat.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the little hatchback, the two-door hatchback versions that were prone to fuel tank explosions.
You know, I think we've mentioned this on the show with you before, Tom. You've seen the movie Top Secret?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
it's one of my favorite comedies of all time. It's the guy, for those people who might not have seen it, it is a truly insane, bizarre, wonderful comedy from the guys who made Airplane, the Zucker Brothers and Jim Abrams. And it has a sight gag involving a Pinto that is pretty priceless. Pretty priceless. And when that movie came out, Tom, that movie came out in 1984. And that was prime time for that joke. At that time, that was I remember in the theater, people roared with laughter because it was not only a hilarious sight gag, but it was unbelievably timely.
Yeah, I want to say, if I recall this correctly, a military vehicle tapped the rear bumper.
Taps the rear bumper of a Pinto, who for some reason is in the middle of a World War II chase. There's a Pinto. It taps it. And not only does it tap it, Tom, the sound effect is ding. And then... And then it's this massive explosion. It's still an amazing sight gag. But back in 1984, that was like, wow, okay, that's good getting that one in there. All right, Tom, hang on, all right?
Will do.
All right, Tom Appel is with us. Any and all car-related questions, text us or call us, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Check him out on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. car_guy_Tom. And we'll answer your questions and talk more car stuff right after we take a break here for the news. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. Steve Grzanich at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 to take you through your morning drive. 720 WGN. Check out WGNradio.com for our podcasts and more. Our phone number and our text number. We got some texts coming in and some calls coming in. 312-981-7200. My guest is Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. He joins us monthly to talk all car and automotive related stories and to answer your questions. Tom, welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, and here is Bob on WGN. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, good morning, Nick and Tom.
Morning.
I'm looking into buying a 2010 Ford Explorer Sport Track, but looking at all the Carfax and that, it's coming from Quebec, Canada. I was the owner of the first. Is that going to be a problem?
Wow, it's probably not going to be a problem with the car used. The only problem you'll experience, and for people who don't know, the Explorer Sport Track was a pretty cool Explorer front-end pickup truck rear-end vehicle that was never all that popular, but people who owned them loved them. Your big problem is that the speedometer is going to be backwards, so you're going to be looking at KPH instead of MPH on the big dial.
Oh, wow. That's going to be confusing.
Okay, but as far as emissions or getting parts or anything like that, it should be fine.
Yeah, no, mechanically, the U.S. and Canadian versions of most vehicles are absolutely identical, except for some very small trim things having to do with daylight running lights and the dashboard. But no, I don't see any problems.
Mm. So you're just going to have to get used to that speedometer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't look at that anyway.
All right. All right, Bob, thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Ah, speedometer. I don't look at that.
Problem solved.
I go 120 miles an hour everywhere I go. that's fantastic. I don't even look at that. That's fantastic. 630 area code, Tom. Do you know why the auto manufacturers and engineers are making it almost impossible to change a headlamp bulb?
No, I don't. I don't know if they're intentionally making it difficult, but I can swear up and down that it is difficult, having tried to do it myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it used to be remove four screws and pop in a bulb, but it's much, much, much more difficult now. Part of the problem, too, is that we don't change the whole bulb assembly anymore. We replace the little halogen bulb or the actual bulb itself, and it's hard to get your hand back there. But part of the problem is that the front end is just more crowded than it used to be.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a hassle. And usually you need someone to do it for you.
Yeah. Now, you know, in general with the newer cars, Tom, I remember, you know, when I was growing up and when I was a teenager and in my 20s and stuff, a lot of my friends would do their own sort of work on their cars and, you know, do certain things. And, you know, a lot of people I knew would get their hands dirty and get under the hood. People just aren't doing that anymore at all. I mean, it's all because of the technology, don't you think?
Yeah, a lot of things have changed. Technology is one thing. There's fewer things you can do. There's no carburetor to clean or rebuild anymore. Air filters are harder to get to. The little stuff we used to do, even oil changes are a pain now because there's all these laws about what you do with waste oil. If you change your own oil, you have to pay someone to take your waste oil.
But you can't just leave it on the driveway?
You used to be able to, and I think it depends where you live.
Okay.
My dad used to just put it in milk cartons and leave it at the end of the driveway.
Oh, yeah.
And presumably, if the garbage guys were taking it,
I knew my buddy used to just keep, you know, like bacon grease in a coffee can?
Yeah.
He'd do the same thing. He would do the same thing with it, man.
Yeah.
So,
who knew where it went?
Who knows? Who cares? I don't even look at the speedometer, Tom. What do I care?
Exactly.
all right, let's talk about those damn millennials.
Yes.
Yeah. no offense, Dan. My producer, Dan Long,
I feel like I'm sitting in with Roe.
Well, so, you know, people are saying that millennials aren't buying cars, but they are.
They plan to. A recent survey by Bankrate.com has identified the group they're calling millennials, and this will be people between the ages of 18 to 29, are likely to be, in the next few years, the largest buying group of new vehicles. Actually, not new, but vehicles in total. We don't know if it's new or used. Mm-hmm. But that does represent a change in what people have understood up until this point. And what could be happening, there's a lot of theories as to what this means because the research isn't very conclusive, but it could be simply that the higher employment rate is putting a little cash into the hands of some millennials. And additionally, because they're working, they need transportation. That could be what's going on. Additionally, the study didn't make the distinction between buying and leasing, so it's entirely possible that older age groups who intended to lease did not indicate their preference to do so because it was the word lease instead of purchase.
Mm-hmm. And what historically, how have people in that age range been in terms of buying in buying cars? That's not a huge, I mean, that's not the big number of people who are buying the cars, is it? That's not the general people who are buying.
No, it's really not. What we really saw is just a combination of general disinterest in new vehicles and just as an after effect of the recession was just that young buyers put off buying cars. And it's looking like now they might be getting back into the market.
Okay. All right. We got a question here from the 815 area code. What does Tom know about the three-wheel Polaris slingshot?
I know that I want one.
Okay.
yeah, that's the coolest looking thing in the whole world. It's two wheels up front, one wheel in the back. It's an open road car. And I think it's about $24,995. They're advertised all over some TV channels right now, and they're cool as heck. They're powered by motorcycle engines, and they fit two people, and they look like an absolute joy.
Now, what rules do they fall under? Do they fall under motorcycle? Do you have to have a motorcycle license? Do you have to have emissions for motorcycle? Or how
yes. That? In Illinois, it would be a motorcycle license.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it depends on the state you live in.
Okay. All right. Before we take a break here, Tom, I always love to ask you, what have you been driving lately? What are you driving now? What did you drive before? Because you're always test driving cars.
Yeah, nice surprise. This fell into my lap today. I'm driving the 2016 Jaguar XJL Supercharged.
Whoa.
Yeah, that is the big Jaguar long wheelbase with the supercharged V8 engine. And, yeah, it's just a heck of a car.
I was going to say, that sounds like a fun drive.
Yeah, it is. It is a very big, very roomy, very powerful vehicle. It's what you'd expect a Jaguar to be these days.
Right. And, again, I appreciate that you didn't say Jaguar.
No, I will never do that.
I understand that. And what were you driving before that, Tom?
I recently got out of, I'm trying to think what I just drove. Oh, I was in the Toyota Highlander XLE. So this is the mid-level, mid-size crossover from Toyota, right in the sort of price sweet spot, right around $38,000 to $41,000, right about where most crossovers go. Nice vehicle. What I like best about the Highlander is just that the V6 is just such a sweet engine. It's very smooth, very refined, very quiet. But Highlander is right in the middle of that market, and it's something people have to look at.
Very cool. And people can see your thoughts on these cars at Consumer Guide Automotive at consumerguide.com.
Absolutely.
All right. And follow Tom on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. That's car_guy_Tom. One more question here. Here's Mark on WGN. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, I'm looking to get a 2016 Mustang EcoBoost Sport Turbo. Anything about that, you know?
Yeah, I spent some time in the convertible and the coupe. and I've driven that engine with both the manual and the automatic transmission, and it's great. For people who don't know, the V8 engine is still the 5-liter V8 engine is still the top engine in the Mustang, but they've added a 2.3-liter turbocharged four-cylinder that really gets the job done. It's about 300 horsepower, feels great, it's smooth, it's torquey, and it's a lot of fun to drive. Yeah, I would probably do that instead of the V8 if I was buying one.
Mm. All right, thanks. I appreciate it, Mark.
Take care, buddy.
You too. Bye.
You know, Tom, I just wanted to mention the piece that you wrote for CGDailyDrive.com.
Yes.
The Nova and the Pistachio Shake, How My Dad's Chevy Betrayed Me. It's a lovely story about a Chevy Nova. Can you give us a little background on that?
Yeah, this is a cathartic piece to finally write 45 years after the fact. If anyone remembers it, in Niles, there was once an ice cream store called Carvel. And my father and I were prone to stopping there on our trips to the Chicago, or coming back from Chicago out to our house in Palatine. And one day, long story short, their special flavor of the day, they always had vanilla chocolate and a mystery flavor, was pistachio.
Yeah.
I insisted on a pistachio shake because it was green and it looked good. My father insisted I would not like it. Well, I hated it. And again, long story short, on the way home, I secretly poured it out the window. And I was sure I had gotten away with this. But when we got home, the side of the car was just plastered with this sort of Day-Glo pistachio shake.
And what were the consequences of that, Tom?
The only thing my father said was, "You really like pistachio."
That's a great story. It's a lot of fun. Oh, the old Chevy Nova. Come on.
That was a great car. We love that car.
Yeah, you got to love the Nova. You have to. Yeah. All right, Tom, hang on, all right?
Will do.
Tom Appel is with us, and he is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and he'll answer any and all of your car and automotive questions. We got more car stories to talk about as well. 312-981-7200. You're listening to Nick DiGiulio on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. I'm Nick DiGiulio. I'm your overnight dude here on 720 WGN, 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. Tom Appel is with us. He joins us every month from Consumer Guide Automotive to answer any and all of your car and automotive questions and to talk cars in general. You can check out consumerguide.com, and you can follow Tom on Twitter at @car_guy_Tom, at @car_guy_Tom. Tom, welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
All right, we have another 815 area code. Two questions for Tom. I always owned a Trailblazer. What vehicle would be comparable to a Trailblazer? I will have to buy a used vehicle because I cannot afford a new one. Second question is, well, why don't you answer the first one first?
Sure, yeah. The Trailblazer was Chevrolet's midsize crossover. I shouldn't say crossover. It was an SUV. It was an old body-on-frame truck, usually V8 powered, capable of towing. And the closest thing to that vehicle now of approximately that size would be the Dodge Durango, I think. And there are plenty of those out there used. That's a very nice vehicle. You can get a V8 powered ready for towing and still has some off-road capability. So that might be the closest thing right now.
All right. Pat, our listener Pat, has a second question. Do they make the Silverado out of steel as opposed to the Ford that I heard was aluminum? And do you think the Colorado is a lower or higher priced version in that line of pickup trucks? I really wanted a four-door pickup truck, something similar to the Trailblazer.
Yeah, the whole aluminum versus steel thing is a non-issue, really. It turns out that Ford's doing just fine with aluminum body panels, and they seem to be fairly resistant to dinging and to minor scratching. So good on Ford for having launched that. The Chevy is still all steel, and it's going to be using more aluminum stuff, but not just body panels in the next generation. The Colorado is smaller than those two vehicles. That's the new midsize Chevrolet, very nice vehicle. And certainly worth looking at if you think the big trucks are just a little too big these days.
Okay. 815 area code says, I'm looking at buying a Saturn View SUV because I like that the body won't rust. Are there reasons not to buy one, and what year did they stop making them?
Oh, wow, the Saturn View. That was one of the vehicles that Saturn took up right to the end, so I think 2009 might have been the last model year. Yeah, and those were plastic-bodied. The only downside is that when it gets cold, the body panels contract a little, so there are these huge gaps on the side. It looks kind of nasty. But that's not really a problem. It's just sort of an aesthetic thing.
Okay. All right. All right. You wrote a piece about a surprising number of people who are driving who are confused by the auto safety features. Can you talk a little bit about that and clear some of that up?
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing. I was recently treated to a presentation by an organization called MyCarDoesWhat.com. I'm sorry, .org. And this organization is a joint effort from the National Safety Council and the Center for Public Policy at the University of Iowa. And what they're trying to do is determine to what extent people do or do not know about the safety features on their cars. So they conducted some research. They talked to 2,000 licensed drivers who own vehicles and asked them some pretty simple stuff. And what we learned was a little bit alarming, or what they learned was a little bit alarming. Something as common as cruise control, 6% of all drivers did not know what cruise control was or how it worked.
Oh.
But it gets a little scarier when you get to things like traction control, which is now standard in all vehicles. 27% of respondents did not know and did not understand how traction control worked. And then when you get to the newer features, the stuff that we're now seeing on better-equipped new cars, like forward collision alert, fully 45% of respondents did not know what forward collision alert was, even though it's coming online pretty quickly.
Wow. So what... Oh, man. Now, this website that you're talking about, MyCarDoesWhat.org.
Yeah.
Do they have explanations for these things that people are having trouble with?
Yeah, they do. This is an interesting organization. They're actually funded by money. We talked about that Toyota recall recently. Toyota was dinged by the government for having dragged its feet on sharing some of the facts about the recalls it was executing and the problems it was having with those cars, and was fined a substantial amount of money. A lot of that money has gone to this organization. They now have the website, MyCarDoesWhat.org, where they're trying to educate people about these systems. It's a pretty nice website. It's fun to visit, but it deals with most of the stuff. But their goal is to, before their money runs out, to educate the public about new safety features and how they can help save lives.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so many gadgets and technology features in cars now. I would imagine some drivers might feel a little overwhelmed if they get a new car.
There's a lot of stuff. And if you've been out of the market for 5 years, which is fairly typical, you don't know about any of this stuff. And why would you? If you don't care, if you're not a car guy, there's no reason that you would know what blind spot alert is or lane departure warning or any of that stuff, because it just wasn't there before.
And things like the backup camera.
Right.
And I mean, you know, if you get a vehicle that does the self-parking, that's
exactly.
That's got to freak people out.
As it should.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can get more explanation at MyCarDoesWhat.org. MyCarDoesWhat.org.
Yes.
I always love some of the pieces that you write where you pick specific cars from specific years. And you pick the fantastic year of 1972, Tom.
Yes.
To write a couple of pieces. You've got the 5 slowest cars and the 9 fastest cars of 1972. Let's talk about the fastest ones first, because that's the most amusing considering how fast cars were then.
Yeah, and I just want to explain something very quickly. I get so much angry email about these times. These were the times that were conducted by consumer guide editors and not Car and Driver. So,
okay.
I want to make that distinction because we don't do several things that Car and Driver used to do. So these times do seem a little slow.
Okay, all right. Well, what do we got? How does that list work out?
All right, so the fastest cars of 1972, a car that no one thinks of as sporty, the Dodge Coronet.
I'm telling you, Tom, I love the names of these cars. I'm telling you, they're just classic.
Dodge had a bad habit in those days of changing the names of its mid-sized cars all the time.
Uh-huh.
And so many of them just fall into the little obscure, dusty corners of our brain. And I guess I remember the Coronet. But this car was good for running 0 to 60 in 11.4 seconds.
Oh, man. That's speedy.
Yeah, and that's the Rocket. That's the Rocket of the bunch.
Yeah, okay. All right. And let's go to the slowest cars of 1972. What do we got is the slowest? It's a Beetle, right? Oh, the Super Beetle.
The Super Beetle.
Right. What's the difference between the Beetle and the Super Beetle?
The Super Beetle actually replaced the Beetle. I think there might have been 1 or 2 years where they were both involved. But the Super Beetle had a couple of additional features. One of them was a slightly larger, more powerful engine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I just lost. Ah, all right, my phone just betrayed me.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, the Super Beetle is good for 0 to 60 in about 18 seconds. It was an embarrassment to anyone who needed to be any place in a hurry.
4-speed manual, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, 19.5 seconds. And that was followed closely by the legendary Chevrolet Vega.
The Vega, another Vega. Fantastic car.
Yeah, in about 20 seconds.
About 20 seconds. Oh, my God, really hilarious. And some of the fastest cars, the second fastest was the Pontiac Le Mans.
Yes.
And the Ford Thunderbird was right up there, too.
Yeah, and that's back when engines were still monstrous. The Thunderbird was a strange car in those days, too, because it was really Lincoln-based. It wasn't the car it became later on when it was more Starsky and Hutch Torino-based.
Hmm. You got the LeBaron is on there. The Firebird was 12 seconds.
Yeah, now that there's something about that. These are the cars as tested by Consumer Guide. There were faster versions of the Firebird. There was still a Formula 400 and a Trans Am that would have done better and probably would have topped this list.
Yeah.
And had we tested a Corvette this year, that probably would have won.
The Corvette would have, in 72?
Yeah, we did not test a Corvette that year.
You didn't test a Corvette that year. Okay. All right. If you're looking for the results of this stuff, you can always check it out at consumerguide.com and cgdailydrive.com for more information. Very, very cool stuff. And Tom can be followed on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. That's car_guy_Tom. Tom, always a pleasure, and it goes by really fast every time you're here. And if people want to get a hold of you, can they email you or can they message you at the website?
Yeah, there's contact us stuff all over both websites. So yeah, feel free to get a hold of me.
Okay, consumerguide.com and cgdailydrive.com for more information. You can always follow Tom on Twitter at car_guy_Tom. Tom, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next month.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Have fun.
All right, there you go. There's Tom Appel, everybody.